a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, we're speaking with Jennifer Nagy, who is a research professor at the Weber State University, my alma mater. And she's been talking about something and doing research on something that I honestly, Jennifer, I thought it was gone. or at least, you know, technically speaking, redlining in housing and discrimination in housing. And can we talk a little bit about, first of all, thank you for being here. Can you give us some context on redlining and
what
discrimination
is it? Yeah.
And what it is?
Sure. So first of all, thank you for having me. A really simple description of redlining is the denial of credit for a mortgage loan to a creditworthy applicant due to the characteristics of the neighborhood in which it is located rather than the qualifications of the applicant themselves.
So that is to say, if you're a person of color, rather trying to move into a certain neighborhood that is generally predominantly white, they would make it so that you wouldn't be able to get a loan for that particular area.
So yes, in general, but it's interesting that you had the example in an area that's predominantly white, right? A person of color trying to buy a home or get a mortgage loan in a neighborhood that's predominantly white, because redlining was primarily used to deny loans to people looking to buy houses in communities of color. And then a sister tool that was used to exclude people of color from predominantly white neighborhoods was the racially restrictive covenant. And these are deed restrictions on residential properties that pretty explicitly prohibit the sale or rental of the home. In Weber County, the wording tends to be to anyone other than the Caucasian race.
So do these still exist in that kind of explicit term?
So they my research currently is on identifying and mapping these racially restrictive covenants in Weber County.
That's in Utah.
Yes.
Northern Utah.
Which is in northern Utah, yes. And these covenants were recorded through the county recorder on these residential properties. All of the ones I've found three, all of the ones that I've found were from the 1940s. And once something is recorded, it's there, right? It's part of the history of that property.
So is it in the property description or what? When you say a covenant, like what? Because I think of covenants as like a HOA type of rule. So what?
Yes. And oftentimes, in fact, in the three instances where I have found these covenants in Weber County, the covenant is recorded by the original land developer prior to the homes being built.
Okay. Gotcha.
So it's recorded on a subdivision, and I've found them anywhere from like a single block to, you know, six blocks of homes in this subdivision.
So you might buy a home and not know that it has this covenant.
That's correct. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
So I don't know if HOA is the correct term, but it was recorded on all properties within the subdivision, and it included oftentimes these racial restrictions are, you know, a few sentences within a 3-page document mm-hmm. about other restrictions that the developer is putting on the property, like how many stories high your home can be and how big your garage can be mm-hmm. and what is the minimum square footage of a home that you can build on the property, et cetera, et cetera. So amongst all of these more technical restrictions, at least on some properties in the 1940s that I found in Weber County, they also had these racial restrictions included in these covenants.
Let me back up just a second and ask you, you said redlining was essentially used to keep people from buying property in mostly black or communities of color. Help me out with that. Like, why would they restrict a white person from moving into a black or a you know, mixed ethnicity neighborhood?
If they would deny a mortgage loan to a white person looking to buy a home in a community of color, my understanding is that that did not happen very frequently. Mm-hmm. But I also understand that, let's think of a neighborhood that's like 50-50, right? And there were integrated neighborhoods, a few of them, in the 1940s. And then I think you can make a pretty strong argument that because of redlining, there became fewer of those integrated communities. But my understanding is that lenders, banks, and then also the federal government and the Federal Housing Administration, which is the big federal government program that insures mortgage loans to help expand home ownership, even perceived integrated communities as poor credit risks. And it was difficult for people of any race to get mortgage loans in integrated neighborhoods. That's my understanding.
So essentially, our federal government, and obviously locally it became this way too, they were creating segregated communities throughout the country.
If it's the banks, if it's the lending institutions making the decisions, who's doing this? Help me with that.
Yeah. So.
You got about a minute.
Okay.
No pressure.
And we can come back to it. But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Federal Housing Administration, particularly in its early years, so 1934 to about 1950, basically wrote in and condoned redlining in its underwriting manual. So it advised against insuring mortgages from private lenders, right? Because that's the way the FHA works, is it doesn't make the mortgage loans, but it insures the mortgage mm-hmm. loans of private lenders. And according to the FHA underwriting guidelines, the FHA was not to insure mortgage loans for neighborhoods that were subject to adverse influences, put that in quotation marks, and among adverse influences was the infiltration of inharmonious racial groups. That is a quote from the 1935 FHA underwriting manual.
I've never been called inharmonious. That's
we're engaged.
That
in
is some serious code switching going on there, right? When we come back, I'm going to have you discuss it a little bit more because, again, it's hard to hear, but it's one of those things that we are better for learning.
So yes, we should understand this.
And I think this is how neighborhoods.
That's why
were
your research is so important.
When we come back, we will continue our discussion with Professor Jennifer Nagy, talking about redlining and its development over years and decades in our country. You're listening to Voices of Reason.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
We We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. Jason Lee, Amy Donaldson, speaking today with Professor Jennifer Nagy, who is studying, well, she is an economic researcher at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. And she has been studying the redlining, which is propagation of discrimination in housing, lending, and how neighborhoods have been developed. And we've been talking about this, and I've kind of understood the history of this for a long time, particularly as it started back in the 30s and 40s and right after World War II. And it has been such a huge influence on how neighborhoods across the country have actually developed, and why there was such prevalent segregation. And this is one of Jennifer's first times kind of doing something like this, and she's been struggling a little bit because explain to us kind of how you feel about having to discuss this in such an open forum.
Yeah, so I feel like this is a difficult subject to talk about for several reasons, right? One is that we have willfully deferred this discussion for about 80 years. And so we just haven't practiced talking about this. I think another reason is that it's ugly and it's shameful. And I am an upper middle class white woman. I teach economics at Weber State University. I have not found a racial covenant on my home, but I live about two or three blocks south in a neighborhood that does have covenants. And my house is about 3 or 4 years newer than those homes. And I think it's probably simply the fact that the Supreme Court ruled these covenants unenforceable between those homes two blocks north mm-hmm. versus mine, that mine didn't have one. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I maybe shouldn't speculate on that. But the point is that I live in a neighborhood that's very close to these covenants. And
was likely shaped by the covenants,
right? And was likely shaped by the covenants. And as I'm learning what happens, I'm also learning how to talk about it. How can you talk about something like this in a dignified way that has such an ugly and shameful origin
in history?
Yeah, I guess I don't think it should be. I mean, I think we should be, you know, civil and I guess solutions minded. But I don't know that we have to be like, it is ugly. And I think it's just like anything in our history, right? Like, none of us perpetrated this. None of us were involved in the drafting of these covenants or any. I think that dragging it out into the sunshine, your research into how these things were worded, in what ways they did influence lenders or because that's what I don't understand. I understand the concept of redlining, right? You couldn't get a loan in certain neighborhoods because of who you were. And I remember hearing it one, and I don't know that less than 5% of World War II, black World War II veterans took advantage of housing benefits that they earned by fighting in World War II.
We're able to take advantage.
We're able to. And I just don't, like, I under, and I've read, it, that triggered me kind of reading and researching that idea, but I feel like people don't understand why they wouldn't be able to take advantage. Like, what was stopping them? How did this work, right? Because people are very fond of saying there is no institutional racism. And this, right, what you're doing is really defining what institutional racism looks like. You are showing us an example of how it was institutionalized.
One example.
One tiny in one county in Utah, right? But I think it's not an exception, right?
Correct. Redlining, both redlining and racially restrictive covenants were widespread practices across the United States, particularly in the northern and western states where we didn't have the explicit type of Jim Crow mm-hmm. laws that they had in the South. I think it's a common misconception that this sort of institutionalized housing segregation was something that only happened in the South, but quite the contrary. Both redlining and racially restrictive covenants were widely used and practiced in northern and western states. And in fact, this idea that I have to identify and map racially restrictive covenants for a county is not in any way unique. They've done this in Minneapolis and Hennepin County. They've done this in Seattle. They've done this in Washington, D.C. They've done this in Johnson County, Iowa. And there's a handful of other places that have done this very thing and made this history accessible and tangible to their communities.
And you've probably looked at that research. What did you learn from looking at those other cities and what they had done?
I have learned several things. I've learned that racial covenants came in a variety of flavors. So sometimes, and again, all the ones that I found in Weber County were this particular flavor where the developer records the restrictions on all of the properties within the subdivision prior to development. But other cities have also found instances where after a neighborhood has been developed and people are living in the homes, the neighbors band together and organize and form a coalition to record a covenant on their property at that time. So when you're looking for these covenants, sometimes they're one of the first documents recorded on the property if it was recorded by a developer. But even if you don't find that, you kind of need to still keep looking because it's very possible that the neighbors got together and organized several years later to record a covenant as a group.
And I don't know if your research includes this, but I think it's important to point out that the reason this mattered was because there were a lot of things that flowed from what a community looked like, who lived there, how affluent it was or wasn't, including were there stores, schools, whether or not it was a walkable community or whether or not you built a polluting, factory right next door to it or in the middle of it or cut it in half with a freeway. There are all those kinds of things that flow from who lives in a place. And I don't know, does your research include that or is it going to come from that?
At this point, I have looked at relationships between historical redlining. Again, I don't have a complete set of covenants. So
yeah,
the
because there's got to be a variety of those, yeah.
Right. And like I said, I've found three, and I've been developing the idea for this research project for about a year, but I only got a grant to hire a research assistant to go to the recorder's office and dig some of this stuff up. I think this is her third week on the job.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
this is very, very early stages of this.
So when we come back, I want to discuss kind of historically what that has meant leading up to today.
Yeah.
Because we all know that one of the best things you can do for yourself economically is to own property. But when you are unable to and institutionally made to buy property that's going to be inherently less valuable, it changes the dynamic of what the future looks like for people in that particular group. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with economics professor Jennifer Nagy. You're listening to Voices of Reason. We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. Amy Donaldson, Jason Lee, speaking today with Weber State University economics professor Jennifer Nagy, who has been enlightening us on kind of the development and history of redlining, which is redlining was housing, discrimination.
Yeah.
It's beyond maddening for me because to me, it is one of the most important, say for slavery and Jim Crow, impactful institutional methods of discrimination that have for decades, and today it is still one of the things that have created the wealth gap in our country.
Yeah.
But you were mentioning that, when you in doing some of your research, that you see, as Amy brought up, how neighborhoods were developed in a way that would, like I said, talk about this less valuable stuff where the infrastructure was different. They were in certain neighborhoods, they were allowed to have factories, whereas in other places, there was nothing like that. There were no freeways splitting up.
They don't even want an apartment complex in their neighborhood.
In those neighborhoods. Yeah, I want to speak to two things. One is Levittown, New Jersey, which if you haven't heard about this, Levittown was one of the first, after World War II, mass developments developed by a guy named Levitt, just outside of New York. It became what was, quote unquote, the American dream middle class community. Mm-hmm. And they had strict covenants on who could live there. And if you were black or brown, they were not having it. And that is how wealth was developed for those people who lived there, and all of them were white, and moving forward. And also, Edward Moses, was it either Edward or James Moses? James Moses. He was an administrator in New York City who part of the reason why the Brooklyn Dodgers then moved to Los Angeles was because this guy decided we're going to build the freeway right through what was going to be Ebbets Field. And they wanted to try to develop a new park there. Walter O'Malley did, but they didn't do it. One guy made this decision. He changed the course of history. But also, he made it so that those areas were going to be specifically the poorer areas of the borough.
Yeah, he made them a place where people who had money didn't want to live.
Absolutely.
Why would you want to live there? So when you compared those zoning maps with the redlining maps, what did you find?
Right. So I'll be clear that what I'm going to say, I can really only speak to Ogden City in Weber County. Mm-hmm. Because I'm an economist, I want
to overstate
clear
it.
Right. I don't want to imply causation without sufficient data to back it up. Nevertheless, I think the correlations are strong enough that they're worth talking about. So, you know, in Ogden, I've overlaid the historical redlining map, which was developed and created by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the 1930s, which was a federal agency, and Ogden's present day municipal zoning map, right? And the zoning map says, you know, where you can have commercial development, where you can have residential development, where you can have industrial manufacturing development. And you can see that in areas, particularly on the west side of town, that were much more likely to be the lower grades, the C and D grades, is where the present day industrial and manufacturing zones of the city are located. And then over on the east side, if you're familiar with Ogden, particularly east of Harrison Boulevard, is, you know, pretty much entirely single family zoning. And that's not the only area of the city that is single family zoning. A lot of the northern areas of the cities and some other pockets throughout the city are single family zones. But, you know, Ogden also has different categories of single family homes based on minimum lot size, right? And so if the minimum lot size is large, you're going to have large lots, you're going to tend to have larger homes, and then they're going to tend to be more expensive. And if you look on the redlining map for Ogden, the highest grades indicating affluent white communities were in the southeast corner of that map. And if you look at the present-day zoning map of Ogden, those high minimum lot size, so lowest and the largest lot size single family zoning areas are entirely concentrated in the southeast corner of Ogden. And while, you know, the racially restrictive covenants were ruled unenforceable in court in 1948, neighbors were still allowed to enforce them on each other until the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And the Fair Housing Act of 1968 is what made both redlining as a practice and private enforcement of racially restrictive covenants illegal. On the other hand, today we have, through zoning regulations, some pretty explicit economic segregation of our communities. And because of the way that redlining and racially restrictive covenants denied families of color the opportunity to build wealth through the accumulation of home equity through home ownership, there is a very strong correlation today between socioeconomic status and race.
If you realize how important that is, mm-hmm. over decades and decades, there becomes this disparity. And I know there are some people who are fond of saying, well, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, blacks and Latinos, they've kind of, that was years ago, they should have done better by now. And there's always a suggestion, so, institutional
impediments. It wasn't years ago.
Well,
but
what I'm saying is there are all these institutional impediments that were specifically designed to keep them down.
They just got better at hiding it. They were just up front and writing it into covenant and code. But I think that there is just the hostility of moving into a neighborhood where you know you're not wanted.
That's right.
And where you can't make friends, or you have a higher interest rate loan. These are the ways in which it works. So, yeah, you can't deny somebody a loan in the 70s and 80s and 90s, but you can charge them more money. So, and then the other
makes
thing
it is almost impossible for them to afford it.
Yeah, because I mean, that's, you're talking $100 to $300. So they're paying, you know, you look at it percentage wise, it's only 0.5% or it's only 1%, right? But over the life of a loan, that's a substantial amount of money, and it reduces the opportunity they have to move into a nicer, quote unquote, area, you know, where they're not living by a factory or whatever. But the other thing is insurance rates, homeowners insurance. I know when my daughter had a friend move in with her, she was living in Sandy in Jason's neighborhood. She moved to my neighborhood in Taylorsville, and her insurance rates went up for her car and the homeowners because she was living in a less desirable neighborhood.
And we're talking just a few miles away.
Yeah. And what's the difference in my neighborhood and his neighborhood is more white people live where he lives, and mine is definitely much more mixed race neighborhood. So I think that there are all these tiny little ways in which you don't realize you're paying more for your utilities in some cases, right? There's just all these small little ways in which it adds up, and you just can't afford that, right? It's not one thing. It's not just a racial covenant. It's all these other things overlaid on top of it.
That are a result of that covenant. When we come back, I want to discuss a couple of more things and how this continues to be an impactful circumstance throughout America, certainly not just here in Utah. We're speaking today with economics professor Jennifer Nagy, talking about redlining and its impact in our country and in our state. We'll come back. This is Voices of Reason. We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. Amy Donaldson, Jason Lee, speaking today with Weber State University econ professor Jennifer Nagy, who is telling us about the history of redlining in our state and in our country. And just real quick thing. First of all, the guy's name was Robert Moses. He once held the city official in New York City who decided transit and highways were the thing. So he
with a way to box people in.
Well, box people in. But it also helped develop economically in his mind, and a lot of people agree with him. He went. He was a Yale and Columbia graduate, got a PhD. However, he was not an engineer, but this is what he thought. He did engineer how the city was developed, and Levittown is actually on Long Island, so it's in New York, right outside of New York City. And it all that other stuff I was telling you is the same is true. It just
and it was really like the first suburb. Like
it was
and
the
until
first
then,
mass
people
suburb,
lived in
right.
rural communities or they lived near cities. And the first suburban development was like, look at these beautiful.
That's right.
You know,
they were very similar houses.
Yeah,
And it was on this large
cute
plot of
yard.
Land.
And
one guy made all the money. Okay, but Professor Degger, you had some ideas about redlining and some other things in terms of policy and how it has impacted communities going forward.
So I think one of the implications of this research is that redlining and racially restrictive covenants and other discriminatory housing practices very explicitly created both concentrations of communities of color, of poverty, of disadvantage, but at the same time created these intense concentrations of affluence, predominantly white communities and privilege and power. And I hear oftentimes in policy circles people talking about deconcentrating poverty. And when we deconcentrate poverty, we get better education outcomes and we get better health outcomes. But I think a really extremely important piece that's often missed with that is looking at the other side of the coin, which is deconcentrating affluence, deconcentrating wealth. Because, you know, if we only work on one side of that equation, and we deconcentrate poverty but don't allow people to move into more affluent communities, you're not going to make any headway.
Well, and to that, I think there's debates about this going on right now. I see in Salt Lake County, where are you going to build apartment buildings? Where does
everywhere in Salt Lake County?
Where does high density housing go? Right, and so I see these abandoned old buildings. There's one in my community right now. It used to be a Kmart, and they're talking about making it into high density housing. Right, we have no more property in Taylorsville. We're definitely land and freeway locked. And so they're talking, we need housing. I know in my neighborhood, I walked my dogs this morning, three people living in their cars just on my 2.5 mile walk with my dogs this morning. And I see this throughout the summer, any warmer months. And I think these are people that are working because they have cars and they're gone during the day. And then they just are sleeping in the neighborhood at night because people are not bothering them. I would say if they went to a more fluid neighborhood, they would probably get rousted by the police.
They wouldn't be able to stay there.
Yeah. So I think there's this big debate about, you know, what is this doing to us? We already have two freeways in Taylorsville. We already have the airport going overhead. You know, it's close to a liquor store, which is just a magnet for problems, right? So I think there's a big debate about whether or not this is, it's people keep saying it's not fair that we have to have all the apartments in our neighborhood. And I see this desperate need for housing, and I'm like, well, let's build it here. We need to do something for these people that they can afford. And then I listen to these developers and I see what they're charging for an apartment, and I go, I don't really know what the answer is. Like, maybe they should go to an East Side neighborhood that doesn't have any apartments and build an apartment building. But I don't know that that's good for the people to live in hostility. I mean, how do you decentralize wealth and decentralize poverty? I don't even know what that looks like.
Right. And I don't know if anybody knows what that looks like, because it's a pretty widespread problem that communities struggle with, right? And that type of not in my backyard attitude. And it shows up most everywhere. But I do strongly believe that apartment complexes, but also single family homes and a broad range of housing types belong in every community. And that's pretty politically infeasible, but I think it's important to say as a goal.
Mm-hmm. You know, here's the thing.
I think,
go ahead. Yeah,
I was just going to say, I think at several levels, I think there are starting to be conversations at the state and federal levels, if not at the municipal levels, about finding ways to relax single family zoning laws. It's a pretty big piece of Biden's proposed Jobs Act. And I was just in a meeting yesterday where Senator Andreg and Senator Waldrop were talking about a proposed housing legislation. And I just forget the number of the bill, but mm-hmm. I can send it to you later. Mm-hmm. That at least was starting some discussion about relaxing single family zoning restrictions. And there is pretty good evidence in the literature that in communities that allow a more broad range of housing types in their community residential zones tend to have more racially and economically integrated neighborhoods. So it's not the only effective tool, but it can be an effective tool for deconcentrating affluence. But because of NIMBYism, it's politically difficult.
Okay.
I have decided to try to take a small stab at this. And I think one of the interesting things about racial covenants is that they were powerful because neighbors enforced them on each other. They worked together to establish and enforce this type of exclusion. And I think a really big question is, can we throw that even slightly in reverse and work together as neighbors to establish and enforce norms of inclusion and affirmatively further fair housing in our communities? And I have started to do some organizing around this. I have a website, which is neighborsfurtherfairhousing.org, and I have some information about racially restrictive covenants and ways that you can get involved. I have a Facebook group where people can get involved, and I want to see, nothing is going to completely throw this in reverse, but can this, neighbors working together were part of the problem, can they be part of the solution? Can we work together to build more inclusive communities? And I have some ideas of how to do that, but I'm already over, so.
Awesome. I love that idea. I want to join your Facebook group, even though I don't live in Weber County. And we didn't say this, but Weber County is actually a pretty diverse county. When you take a look at Utah, Weber, Salt Lake, and Carbon are the
Carbon? You really want to do that?
Yeah.
There's no black people in Carbon County.
I didn't say diverse. I didn't say black.
Okay. Well, yeah. With diversity, too. Join us again for the next episode of the Laban Project's Voices of Reason. If you have any comments about our show, please contact us via email at vormed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at ADonSports and at JasonLee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORPodcast. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast in all the places where you find interesting content. Be sure to review our show as well. We'd love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason. Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.